This is Due By Friday, the weekly challenge podcast with Merlin Mann, Alex Cox, and Max Temkin. This week's challenge, watch an episode of Star Trek Voyager.
You have ruined my life.
What happened? What did Merlin do?
You and Dan Benjamin talking about the stickiness of the new iPhone cases and like how it's human skin.
That never occurred to you before.
No.
Wait a minute. Are you both big case boys?
I can't. Here's the thing. I was never a big case boy until the 6S or the 6, because it's a fucking bar of soap. But now I need to go get a leather case because this is it feels like I'm touching it. It doesn't. It feels like synthetic human skin.
Merlin, are you a big case boy?
I'm a big case boy. I have a 6S, so I have to be big case boy. As I discussed on my program with Dan Benjamin, I don't like handling that phone.
It's not a phone. It's soap, and it's terrible, and I hate it. I have a lot of problems, Merlin.
No, but the funny part was when you were doing your very, very funny vlog bit about iPhone cases, and you kept talking about all those silicone cases. That's the thought that came straight to my mind. Is you touch them and it feels like a corpse. And also, don't they kind of stick? You said now they're less sticky. Did you say
that's what it feels like to have sex with a robot in Westworld?
Yeah, I feel like that. Maybe just the first generation.
I think I've been using my case wrong.
and now I want a big phone. I'm such a millennial. Oh boy.
Yeah. I'm fighting it because I don't really need it. I know I mentioned this on the other show, but like my wife's photographs are so good. Like she just
she's got the plus thing.
She's got a 6S plus, and it is. And I'm not one of those like.
I have an iPhone 7 plus.
Well, it's a big boy phone.
It's a big phone. I've got no case. I never put a case on any of my phones. I have the naked robotic core.
Wow, nice pull. I was never, I mean, God, this is so boring. I think I had a case for one of my early 3-ish series phones, but I haven't used one since. And the thing is, part of the beauty of the, I guess, 4 and 5, I mean, 5S is my favorite phone I've ever had. I love the design of it.
Was that the metal edge antenna gate phone? That phone, that's the best, probably the best thing Apple ever made.
That was not antenna gate. That was...
Was that one after?
That was 4.
Whatever. None of those cases affected reception. That whole thing was made up. It was all nonsense.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just that I guess what I'm trying to say is that I never felt the need for one. I have never... Oh, God. This is one of those things like saying, I'm not sick. Isn't that interesting? And then you get sick. I've never... Never damaged a phone. I've never dropped a phone.
Merlin, look down. It's already check your pocket. It is already broken.
Oh God! Left pocket. Port up. Face in. It's.
Can I tell you something? I've had an iPhone since I was able to afford one, which was not the first one, but the second one with the plastic back. Mm-hmm. And what was that? The iPhone
3G.
The iPhone. Oh my God! That was my first phone. The iPhone 3G. My first iPhone, and. I have never put a case on my iPhone, and I have never broken an iPhone until this case design. And within the first month of owning it, it just like flew out of my hands onto the concrete floor of the garage and shattered.
Oh, no.
Never. I my entire life I've had an unprotected iPhone. And you know what? I got right back on that horse, and I've got this big boy that rides around in my pocket.
But you have the we both have the jet black, and for a while I was using
the piano shiny one.
Yes, the piano black, and every time I put it down, this is another John Syracuse problem. I would put it down like a baby or like an egg that I didn't want to crack because the lens. This is so exciting. I could talk about this.
Can I ask you guys another question? I really am struggling with. So, when did the 7 come out?
In September.
Okay, so I've had this phone for not that long, and I went with the big boy. I went with the big phone because I wanted the dual camera and all that business and the bigger battery. That's a very attractive feature. Mm-hmm. I think I regret getting the big phone. I think I wish I had a small phone because here's the thing. I also have an iPad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And if you are committed, like I have an iPad, I have the small iPad Pro, and it's probably a pretty close tie with the SE30 for my favorite Apple device I've ever owned. It's,
wow.
It's peerless. It's, the size is perfect for me. It's, I find it easier to handle than my phone, and I use it for everything. I'm not everything, but I mean, like, given any other choice, I would prefer to do it on that device. It is lightning fast. It looks great. And so the thing is, once you've used an iPad a lot, you really start to see these devices as being, I think, four different things. Where at first, like if you went out and bought, you know, any kind of second dingus, for a while you go like, oh, I should really use my Kindle more. I should do this. Like once you've done it for a while, though, you don't have to think about it. You say, well, okay, I know that if I'm going to read a lot of stuff, you know, I'd rather just do it on the iPad. There's some kinds of things where like it's just easier to grab the phone. Like for example, for doing like a voice memo or something, you know, and the phone's right there, and I'll grab it. I don't have to think twice about it. But yeah, I think once you've gotten into that lifestyle, it's kind of hard to go back.
None of this is making it into the edit. But
Max, you're killing me.
I have two odds and sods for you, Merlin.
You spill so much seed upon the ground. You're killing me. You cut out so many things.
Got to keep it tight. Got to keep it a tight hour.
There's no need for tight. No, come on, really?
Tight hour. You get,
what is
get,
this, 2007?
You
come
get in,
on.
You get out, you're in 1 hour. If I could get that sucker down to 40 minutes, then we'd really be moving. All right, I got two things for you. I went to the Apple Store to get some holiday presents. And, you know, you never leave the Apple Store without getting a little something for Dad, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I'm Dad. And I got the – so I decided that I own the Smart – what do they call it? The Smart Keyboard for the iPad Pro, the Apple official Apple accessory, and I never put it on.
It's terrible.
It's not.
The one that's built into the case.
The one that is built into the case that Apple provides.
Yeesh.
I just couldn't ever get into using it. Like I even on an airplane or something. Like I almost would rather just sort of type on the soft keyboard on the screen. But anyway, I just sort of on a whim, I saw that Logitech has a line of cases called the Logi, L-O-G-I, for iPad Pro. And it has... Oh,
wait, that's not a dumb name. That's a dumb... Oh, no, it is. It's called the Logi.
Yeah,
okay.
Oh, Alex... shit, Alex has the same one.
Yeah,
look at that. She just pulled it out.
Because it's,
and it's got a holder in the fold, in the flap, in the little skin flap, you can fold in the pen.
It's a pencil.
Oh, I never use the pen because
it's a pencil.
It's the pencil. Sorry. Excuse me. I never use this fucking thing because I'll bring this pencil with me now. Like never. It just sits in a little jar on my desk and I never have it when I want it. But now it rides around in my case and I feel like I'm going to get a lot more use out of this thing. And then I have one more odds and sods for you, Merlin. Are you aware of, I learned about this from my friend James T. Green. Are you aware of Press to Record?
Yes.
Oh.
I keep meaning to use it more. I heard Serenity Caldwell talk about it a long time ago, and it's kind of a wet dream to have something like that, and I need to remember to use it more because it's magic.
So let me tell you.
Have you seen this? Have you seen this app, Alex?
Yeah, I think Alex and I are both on it because of James.
Mm-hmm.
This is like one of my top pick apps across the entire Apple ecosystem. They also have a Mac version now. And like, what's fucking awesome about it is it lives in a widget and it's one button. You pull the widget sheet down, you hit tap, you say your business, you're done, you walk away. And then you sit down at your computer later, there's your voice note. Fucking transcribed.
Transcribed. If it just was the recording, you go, that's a really good idea. But the fact that it transcribes it and mostly gets it is crazy.
Good enough that I can, that it's good enough. It transcribed good enough that I understand it, right? It's like I know what I was talking about when I was in. I use that constantly. It's such a good app. It's so good.
Yeah, I got to remember to use it more. I meant to do it as a way to remember my dreams, and I forget.
Well, you can't. But what are you going to wake up in bed and say your dreams into the? You can't talk because
that's the use case, yeah.
Your special lady friend is asleep.
All right, pause. So I think Max and I are both wondering, so you would wake up in the middle of the night then and just whisper into your phone what You had just experienced.
You're lying next to your partner. She's asleep. And you're like, Siri, begin a new note. No, excuse me. Siri, append to my note dreams.
Mm. See, when you say it like that, it sounds really weird.
Permiso.
No, no, permiso. I would say I would get up and like a gentleman. I'd pull my watch to my mouth and I would say, I was in college, except I wasn't in college. And you were there, only it wasn't you. And I had to eat a turtle and had to get my father to wear a donut, you know, or whatever.
Permiso.
Permiso. Permiso. Tell it to the ancient bird. This is Odds and Sods. This isn't going to go in the show. Let me see if I can find any. Let me see if I can find some that I had not read to John. Let's see. I got some good ones here. Dreams. Oh, here's some dreams.
Boy, I wish I remembered my dreams.
Yeah, here we go. In every home, there's a place, kind of like an alcove, phone booth, or even just organic looking hole in the wall. Original idea is you whisper your dreams in there while they're fresh. But it could also be that it's for some kind of confession. And we're taught that it's totally private and stays there forever. It turns out to be like an ancient animal. You're literally speaking into the ear of an ancient bird that seems dead. It remembers everything.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Some of these are really good. And I just have, okay, so this is, I'm just going to, I haven't, I'm cold reading this. Later, genre of sci-fi. It's okay to explain away something with because science, almost like censorship style black dots, but a big metaphorical dot over something and say, hey, it's this way because science or whatever else just made it that way, even though you haven't figured it out yet, at least in the story.
I agree with.
Yeah. But there was like dots will echo, editing style dots over something. I knew that there was something important behind the dot, but it had been redacted.
I'm worried that this is going to be a challenge, documenting our dreams.
Well, Alex doesn't sleep, and I haven't remembered a dream since I was 6 years old, so that's going to be a tough challenge.
You should try my herbal sleep medicine.
I'll take some pills and go to sleep.
Don't spoil it. I got a challenge for you this week.
Okay. Let me see. Okay. And then final odds and sods question on the iPad. So let me ask you this. I'm trying to adopt like an iPad. So I have this iPad Pro and I use it to like watch Netflix in bed.
So the big boy, you got the big boy?
I had the big boy. I returned it and I got the normal boy because the big boy was too bright for me to watch Netflix in bed. It was basically like I was sitting in bed with a widescreen television 6 inches away from Veronica's face when she was trying to sleep. It was not taking. So I have the normal iPad boy and I use it. I don't know. What do I read Instapaper on it? I take it on airplanes with like movies on it. It does not get enough use for how great of a device it is. So help me out here. Like, what am I supposed to be? How do I adopt this iPad-based lifestyle? Like, what do I need to be doing? Like, you know, so I like have my computer at work, and I pretty much like putter around on my giant phone all day at home. Like, what are the kinds of things that should be going on this iPad?
Well, Alex, you want to go?
Yeah.
I got a few, but you think about everything more than I do. I don't think about these things. I think you think about how you use these things way more than I do.
I mean, I agree. I do think about shiny toys a lot more than most people should. But are you familiar with the show Canvas that Federico Vicici does, Max?
I'm familiar with it in that it's a show I would listen to if I had a different lifestyle.
It's a really good show.
So, but there is just a series about, it's maybe three episodes about the app workflow, and it is awesome.
Called the Apple Workflow?
No, there's an app. It's called Workflow.
Sidebar, let me ask you about, I'm familiar with Workflow. Every 6 months I install Workflow and I try to make a workflow. I spend like 3 hours and I'm like, this will improve my productivity. And then half the day goes by and then I delete Workflow. Tell me one workflow that you use ever. Do you have any?
Well, I mean, it's the thing is at this
button
point,
on your home screen. Get me an Uber to the closest pizza.
Your condition, because I have the same condition, which is that at a different time in my life, that's all I would have done all day is play with Workflow. That's like what I used to do for work and for funsies. There's so much you can do. I think there's the level you eventually get to, which is not where either of us is now. The level you eventually get to is, oh, I need a way to do this thing that's currently difficult to do. The level you get to before that is that you change other people's scripts. The level you get to before that, though, is just blue sky. Think about, is there something crazy that I need to do sometimes that is currently difficult to do. And I think one Alex might be able to chime in on is sometimes there's embedded audio on a page that you'd like to put somewhere else. Like I like putting stuff into Overcast to be able to listen to. That's my go-to place. And the thing is, the community, I'm saying this because at this point, the community that has created workflows is big enough that there's a pretty good chance if there's an itch you want to scratch, there's something that's very close to what you want. And the general idea is
bookmark it, Huff Duffer, problem solved. What's next? What do you got?
The idea is like, if you just, I think the general mindset that I bring to this is there stuff that is someplace that's hard to get onto this device or somewhere else? Or is there something I have on this device that I need to get somewhere else? That's very general. But I think with that in mind, you can do a lot of stuff with getting things to a PDF, getting stuff. You can download YouTube videos and turn it. I've turned YouTube videos into MP3s on my iPad. Okay. And then been able to upload them. So things like that.
For
that's
like
my,
a
that's
children's
start,
magic but. Show? Like why though?
Well, I mean, there's
like a
for example,
like a party trick?
Well, like with Huff Duffer on a desktop, there's a bookmarklet somebody made. I think it's on GitHub. But somebody made a really cool service where you can basically point when you're on a page with a video on it, especially a YouTube video, you hit the bookmarklet, and it does some Disney magic where there's like a Heroku somewhere that basically tears the audio out of that MP3, uploads it to Huff Duffer, and now you can listen to like a TED Talk or something without having to watch the video. It's on your Huff Duffer now, so consequently, it's in your Overcast.
Merlin, my good friend, are you familiar with the new thing Zinc?
Maybe. Oh yeah, I did. It's the thing Gruber was talking about.
Yes, it goes on the Apple
TV. I use Plex. I use Plex for that.
Sure, same situation. But I don't know. It's just like, how much of my life am I going to spend? How much like of my life will I invest so I can listen to the audio of a TED Talk in the app that I want on my iPad?
Okay.
Like versus just fucking opening my laptop like a grown up and watching the TED Talk.
All right, Johnny Clarendon. Don't become incurious. You are too young to become incurious. You have plenty of time to become a grizzled old man about this.
Mm-hmm.
Keep your mind open to what is possible. Now, Alex, jump in here because I know
you spend
time
book?
With these things.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Well,
why don't people just read books anymore?
I don't understand this. Why can't the kids play with their stick and hoop?
Why do people go out to eat? Who's
Ball
coming up with
cup.
This stuff?
It's so cheap to eat nutrient bars at home.
Has anybody ever really thought about glass? Who's using this stuff?
All right. So I think, Max, we talked about this a while ago, how your job has changed so much that you really don't need your laptop when you are not at the office.
Yeah, that's pretty much. Although, okay.
Well, I mean, unless you're playing over. Let's assume that all you want to do is like do some like really light stuff in the creative suite or something like that. Or let's say you want to yell at a certain subsect of employees.
Mm-hmm.
And
all of them.
Yeah. So
simultaneously.
You could just, exactly. You just create a workflow that's like
Siri, implement employee discipline program
yeah.
Delta.
You're like, okay, text event. You can have a widget that makes a little app icon and then it just sends a group text to people, and then I like have that implemented with Text Expander, and
but,
it's just.
But
it's
how many have you ever
things.
Done? Have you ever done the math on this? So let's say it's going to take you.
Oh God!
It's going to take you 2 hours to like install workflow and set this whole thing up and add it to your home screen and debug it and make it work, right? Now,
why would I dig a well when I already have a bucket?
So.
Have you ever really thought about how much would you actually use the water from that well? We've already got a perfectly serviceable stream. I've got a bucket. Why don't people use buckets anymore?
Oh, man.
I'm just saying, like...
You are just saying. You want a way to say to your computer, execute order 66, and all of a sudden, everybody turns into a stormtrooper, you wipe out the entire Chicago facility.
That's all I want. Listen, I come back when workflow can empty the litter box.
am I right? You need another $1,500 cat box.
When that fancy cat box has IFTTT support, you will be able to have a workflow that's empty my...
I see. IFTTT. Yeah. Tell my Westworld robot to empty the litter box.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a very, very mundane use of my iPad that has become very precious to me. And so I do a lot of stuff with text files. To me, like text files are like where stuff goes. And I use editorial for that. So on, as you know, I'm very tightly wound about how I organize my screens. You know, I like to be real careful about the only thing that's like a consistent thing on my devices is that editorial is always in the lower right hand corner these days because I want my right thumb to always be able to hit it. You hit editorial, it opens up, and you're probably already inside a text file, which is cool. Editorial also has the ability to add bookmarks up at the top of the screen. So I have something called today.taskpaper, and that's where I do most of my figuring out what I've got to do today. And so I just hit today, it pops up, and I'm doing task paper style, just typing in there. It's very easy to do. It's very fast to do. I can get to it. And like, it's just a joy to do on the iPad. And I know that that's not sexy, that's not exciting, but like when I'm laying in bed and I want to start capturing show notes for thinking about what we're going to do, I just created it. Sometimes I'll just go, easiest for me is I go to drafts, I type something, I hit create new file, I pop over to editorial, I just start typing. And it's a breeze. You can export it as HTML. You can print it. You can do whatever with it. That's really mundane. But then you can also do stuff like color. You could use pigment with your Apple Pencil. That's really fun to do. You could color.
I just want to point out that Merlin has I have a problem with this system in that I do not have the big boy iPad. I have the reasonably sized iPad, but I still am a big bed reader, and I fall asleep and the iPad crashes to the floor and it has not yet broken. And I keep thinking, man, if I just had a phone that was a little bigger. And with the 5 and 5S, I was so fast at typing with one thumb.
I know. My typing has gone to shit.
Yes.
I used to be so
God
fucking
damn it.
Fast on
Merlin,
the 4 and 5.
Merlin, I want a 5 big... Oh, man.
Now everything's, every word's got commas in it, and I mean to hit the capital, but it makes an A, and it's like, there's like these certain things that for like years now, I keep doing the same dumb typing mistakes. Or like, and the thing is, once you put a comma in accidentally, because you think you hit the space
the
bar,
commas.
But you hit comma.
The commas.
Now it treats it as different words.
Yeah. I see, like, my other boss who is not a phone person, but suddenly she's like a ninja with typing because you got a big phone. And like with events work, which is like when we're like on a site, if I don't have my phone, I'm basically a useless blah. Well, honestly, in every aspect of life, if my phone isn't with me, I'm just a useless person. And I want to be the nerdy phone ninja again.
Can I give you a positive note, Alex?
Sure.
I'm going to try and cut this baby in half. You are young. Your eyes are probably pretty good. You're good. Oh my God, you guys are, how do you guys, you're insufferable. You really genuinely enjoy this. You would benefit from it. I think you should go and buy the nicest large iPhone that you can afford. And I think you would benefit from it. I think you should do it. And I think you should not look back. I'm giving you permission.
Need something for daddy. All right, I'm sorry, Max.
Pick up something for daddy.
I felt really bad last time. Listeners were very nice about I was recording very high. And now I've got my Monster energy drink again, and I'm just all amped up about phones, and I'm so excited to talk about Star Trek. And
can I ask, I have one more question. How do I edit?
And after that, I have a life hack. Go ahead.
How do I edit a PDF on an iPad?
PDF Pen Pro.
Merlin, you want to tell me about something you like?
Yeah, I gotta tell you. Servers submerged in oil. You know, this is another, you know, as you know, I'm very into life hacks in life. And I struggle with sleep. I take sleep things. And, you know, though, I got a tip. If you're falling asleep, sounds like you struggle with sleep, Alex.
Oh, yeah.
Do you struggle to get to sleep, stay asleep, or both?
Both.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I take this herbal thing at night that is fucking great. And I don't know if it would interfere with your chemistry, but I'd be happy to share that with you. It's not costly. It does not make you feel hungover like a Benadryl does, but it works really great. I sleep a lot deeper. I wake up a lot less, and I don't feel like shit in the morning. So I'm going to recommend that to you in a minute. But, you know, here's a really dumb thing to make yourself start paying attention to. And it's been really good for me because I would frequently go, oh, I'm just going to watch this first episode of the OA. And then like I wake up and it's 2:30 and I'm asleep on the couch like a fucking idiot. Pay attention. Start noticing if you yawn. And here's the thing. I know this is going to sound, yawn means you're sleepy, right? But if you're watching TV, you're doing a thing, you're not listening to your body, start paying attention to the first time that you yawn. And start noticing how long it is between the first time you yawn and when your body really wants to go to sleep. And you'll eventually discover you have a window. You have a window of, like, this is a sensible time to go to sleep. If you keep yawning and you keep reading, is it any wonder at all that the iPad falls on the floor? You're not listening to your body. So my advice to you, which is really mundane, is to start paying attention to noticing your body, be a little mindful. Notice when you're getting sleepy and start figuring out how long that means your clock is ticking. It's going to be a certain amount of time before your body wants to go to sleep.
Can you go back to telling me about the chemical that I can take, though?
I really want. Yeah. No, in all seriousness, that's a very
what
good advice. Thank you, Merlin. But please tell us about the chemicals.
Yeah. I mean, let me go look it up. I buy it in big jugs.
I love a big jug of herbs.
Night. It's called Night something.
Now, what do you smoke it or can you vape it?
You put it in your douche,
okay,
and you really, really want to get in there.
You got to butt chug it. That's what the kids do that. The kids do that now.
What's that?
They take a tampon and they put it in vodka.
Oh, my God.
And then up the butt.
People still do
and
that.
You can die of alcohol poisoning.
It's so scary. Why not?
You butt chug.
Oh, God.
Ugh. It's very cost effective. Ugh. It's very cost effective.
Can have big night out.
I mean, I don't know. If you want a quality, like a really quality tampon that's going to absorb it, that's really as much as like two drinks.
That can't be true. Is that true?
Well,
what's the best tampon?
Do lesbians menstruate? Is that a thing?
Please. What tampon is in? What does Gwyneth Paltrow say I should buy as a tampon? I no longer know how to do email on my iPad. The one email app that worked, which was Inbox, which they did some dark evil magic on their side to make the indexing and the search and everything work, so it was fast.
I'm gonna I think you might actually confuse people. You were talking about Mailbox.
Sorry,
correct?
Mailbox. Yes. Excuse me.
Mailbox was great.
Mailbox did some dark magic where I think they actually. This is why I think they went under. Is I believe what was happening under the hood was they were cloning your entire Gmail inbox unbeknownst to you so that it could quickly index.
I have apps that, the app I use right now does that, and it freaks me the fuck out.
What do you use? I want that. I don't care. There's nothing in my email. I'm willing to make this trade.
Oh, my God. Everything you say, it's all going to be in the clip reel someday. I'm kind of nothing to hide. Spark.
I use that, too.
By Riattle. Can I ask you a question? If I go into Mail, the Apple official Apple Mail app, and I search for something in my email, it does not work. Unless it's currently in my inbox.
It works in Spark, and Spark also has saved searches. So I frequently want to go, when I'm getting ready for back to work, I'll go in and search for email to or from b2w@5by5.tv, and so I just made that a saved search. And
you're telling me
that?
You're telling me if I search for email in Spark, in my Gmail inbox, it will find it.
Yes,
absolutely. And it's got booleans. I think I don't use them, but I'm pretty sure you can do some pretty cool stuff. I think you might be able to find attachments and stuff. But I found it to be very reliable.
I've tried every email app on that exists post Mailbox, and they're all like some sort of fucking monkey paw where they will fix some problems but create new problems.
Yep. Yeah, I agree.
And the thing with Spark, too, is you can have custom gestures. So I just remapped it to what the Mailbox gestures used to be. So I can still have my swipies in the right
spot.
Wow,
that's a huge time savings.
You know?
Well, I mean, the thing that I do, and I'm not proud of this, but actually I just looked at my phone for a second to see what I have for email. Right now I'm in my inbox. And because it's after 10:20 in the morning, it means everything that I snoozed yesterday has come back up. So I'm going to the bottom. I'm going to swipe from right to left and say, snooze all of my mail until tomorrow because I'm a bad person.
I used snooze actually for the first time yesterday because I'm technically on vacation because I had this. My boss
technically
was very,
on vacation.
My boss is this guy who's so generous with vacation days that I just have a bunch left for 2016.
Well, you're doing a really you've certainly hidden the fact that you're on vacation by
being, it's on your calendar.
But the problem here's the problem is even if you're on vacation, if you're there,
yeah, if you're in the office working, that's what kind of a vacation
you're
is
stealing.
That,
you're stealing time from Max.
Yeah,
if you're not there and being 100%, you don't get to phone it in just because you're quote unquote technically on vacation. Yeah. That's stealing time from Max.
Thank you.
Very true.
All right, let's start the show. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Max. How's it going, buddy?
Good. Who watched a Star Trek this week? Are you guys excited for Star Trek talk?
This is the first Star Trek episode I've ever seen in my entire life.
How is that even possible? That doesn't seem possible. It seems like by osmosis. It seems like just wandering through life, you'd see a Star Trek at some point.
Does that include the original series? You never saw any Star Treks? That's amazing.
So I'm a huge Star Trek fan. I have seen every episode of every Star Trek. I have even sort of hoovered up all of the Star Trek breadcrumbs. Like I'm just like so desperate for any sort of Trek stuff. I've like read all of the books and the comics and the animated series and everything. So I just fucking love Star Trek, I'm happy to talk about what I like about it. But I've been working on over the last few years these sort of episode guides for the series that I love are Next Gen, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. I think those are the pinnacle of the Star Wars. I think that's the pinnacle of the Star Trek sort of canon that's out there. But it's hard to get into. These shows were made to be shown in syndication, and there's lots of clunkers, and they made too many episodes, and the quality is wildly inconsistent. So I'm trying to work on these episode guides that give people a good place to start and then sort of guide them through this sort of minimalist experience where they can get the best of the Star Trek experience without having to see even sit through the bad episodes. So I'm working on my Voyager guide. That's the one I haven't written yet. And I'm trying to pin down, what I'm looking for in a starter episode is you can watch this episode. It gives you a taste of what the show is about at its heart. It cuts right to the bone of what is this show. And then you can watch it. And even if you don't get every single thing that happens, you can sort of decide, like, I like that and I want more of that, or I did not like that and I don't want more of that. So at this point, it's almost like more of like a theory that this episode, it's in the last season of Voyager. It's in season 7. It's called The Void. My feeling is that sort of story-wise, character-wise, thematically, this episode, to me at least, it represents, it's almost like a little microcosm of like, hey, here's what Voyager is about. It's like, here's like the little like thesis statement of the ideas that are interesting in Voyager. And so I was curious to have you guys, as sort of my test viewers, watch this episode and then just give me your honest feedback of like, did you understand what was going on? Was it boring? Does it make you curious to watch more Voyager, et cetera, et cetera? So we've all seen the episode. What were your thoughts?
All right. What I know of Star Trek is mostly what Max has told me about how it's about smart people solving problems in somewhat dire situations and sometimes somewhat boring situations. And this episode is a very, it feels like a very dire, like, oh, we could die if we cannot get out of this spaceship. And but yet everyone remains calm and everyone is rational. And I have never seen Captain Janeway, which I think is she the only lady Star Trek captain, Max?
That's a complicated question.
All right.
In all of the TV series,
like of the major TV shows,
she's the only good.
There are five Star Trek TV series, and only one of them has a female lead as the captain. However, in the Star Trek universe, you do see on screen many captains that are women.
Gotcha. So I was already biased going into it because I was like, I finally get to see the character that Max's cat is named after.
Right.
And I was like so enthralled by her performance, which I was not expecting because, wow, if I could watch this series without the soundtrack, I would really like that because it felt really cheesy and gross. But the thing that immediately struck me about Janeway, and I don't, Merlin, this might be a quote from you, but I really like the idea of, you don't always have to be nice, but you should always be kind. And that is what, like, kind of, I feel like Janeway really, really stuck to that the entire episode. And I don't know if this is her character throughout the series, but, like, in her negotiations, she can kind of be a bitch to people, but it's because she is sticking to her morals and sticking to, I guess it's hard to call Star Trek like a series about pacifists, but she's not going to hurt innocent people, and she remains calm, and I don't know. I think I got more from this episode. I got more out of the characters than I did the actual plot. Because I was kind of confused. At some points, I was sort of confused. Like, wait, who? They got on the ship? What's happening? Which eventually I realized I really liked that there was no shitty space battles. It just kind of cuts to the conversation, which is what I like. Like, you don't see the voting in Congress during The West Wing. You just cut to the conversation.
Yeah, there wasn't. It was. I agree with everything you're saying. And it's, I guess, what they do with teleporting. What do they call it? Or beaming? Like that's much more. It's very important in this episode that there is the ability to make things and people go from one place to another. In a way that is much, you can do a lot more with it than I've seen in like watching old Star Treks, where you usually got to go stand in the tube and, you know, get beamed. But I like the fact that, and this must certainly partly be by virtue of the fact that this is a later season, all that tech has been established. But I liked it because it didn't get in the way. They didn't feel the need. Like, I guess, you know, in the original series, they wanted to show, here's the special effect we have and the little noise that it makes and all of that. I like that they didn't do that. As far as the Max's question, I mean, obviously I would need to watch tons more of these to know if this is the best, but I liked it. I can tell you that this is my second episode of this series I've ever seen. I thought it was really good, especially, you know, if you grade on a little bit of a curve, like this is a TV show, it probably didn't have the biggest budget. I look past all that stuff pretty quickly. And like you, Alex, I think I focus mostly on the characters and their interactions. And even, I guess there's stuff I've picked up ambiently about every series a little bit, but also there's just the kind of tropes of what you know. There's going to be like the funny alien. There's going to be the like the super competent, you know, other alien. So I didn't have any trouble like picking up, given how late in the run it is. I was very happily surprised that my daughter and I, we watched it together. She's 9. Like, she loved it. I loved it. And I felt like we immediately wanted to watch more of the show after watching it. So I would say check plus.
What grade are you in when you're 9?
She's in 3rd grade.
I'm trying to remember if I was sort of watching Star Trek in 3rd grade. I don't think I was. I think I would. That was a little younger than I got into Star Trek. But kids are like hard now, you know? They see stuff.
Well, the biggest barrier for, I think, every generation. I think this has always been true. I think it's comforting to think this is more true now. I'm not persuaded it is, but I think something every generation suffers from is something that looks old. So, for example, people that are only a little bit younger than me think black and white movies look really strange, like when they're kids. Everything you've seen is color. So something that doesn't have color, you know, it's like almost like a Freudian thing. You're like, that has a lack of something. This is weird. Why is this not in color? Or in this case, you know, a funny thing she does sometimes is you go, so there's a big, somebody says something really dramatic. There's a blast of strings and then it fades. And she turns and says, is that where the commercial would be? And I'm like, yeah, that's where the commercial would be. Because
<That's>
commercials are something that
that's
she sees so 4
good.
Times a year in hotel rooms. But I don't want to monopolize. But I thought it was really good. I just put a link in notes to a phrase I learned not too long ago: competence porn, which is usually used in a derogatory way to say like, is this a piece of you know, film, movie, art that's, you know, I think The Martian is sometimes held up as this. Like, there's a certain kind of genre of like, it's a film about watching somebody deal with a difficult situation, and it's just mostly about how super competent they are. And I have to tell you, I enjoy that a lot when it's well done. And in this case, that competence porn was not simply about her ability to stay cool, but obviously also to like deal with her, just her, the principles of, I assume, not Starfleet, what's the Federation, right? Even though she's untethered officially from, like, you know, but they have principles to what they're going to do.
Well, let me tell you a little story background on Voyager. This is like what you would have learned, you know, had you sort of started the show from the beginning. So in Deep Space Nine, which is the one that I wrote the guide about last time, it focuses on this very sort of interesting, like, political situation that's almost like space Jews and space Nazis, and the Federation is sort of dealing with the aftermath of the space Nazi occupation of the space Jews. Then the evil space Nazis are the Cardassians. And what happens is there's a group of colonists and Federation people who feel like the Federation should not compromise or have diplomacy with the space Nazis. And they form a rogue group called the Maquis, and the Maquis are like a Federation resistance cell. And they use terrorist tactics to disrupt the Federation, and they're, you know, they are portrayed somewhat in a sympathetic moral light, because I think it is a question in Deep Space Nine. It has enough comfort with moral ambiguity, which is very new for Star. You know, Star Trek is these very pat, sort of cut and dry little morality, like pastoral tales, like these little morality tales of, like, you know, and then Captain Picard did the right thing and the universe was right and they moved on to the next planet. And Deep Space Nine has the courage to be like, well, what if there's like traitors and dissidents and terrorists and all of this ethical ambiguity? So Voyager starts in this time of Star Trek in the 24th century, which, the Improvised Star Trek podcast says, is a period of peak Star Trek. And they set off. Voyager is like a science vessel, and their first mission is to go into this nebula where the Maquis are hiding and flush out the Maquis. And they're pulled through this complicated thing into this Delta Quadrant, you know, 75 years away from home, like a billion light years away from home, with the Maquis ship. And in the pilot, the Maquis ship, these are these Federation traitors. They have to integrate into the Voyager crew, and they all have to become one crew. And the whole show is exploring, okay, this one Federation ship, they have to work, they're integrated with these anti-Federation terrorists. They're a million miles away from the Federation. How far do they bend their morals? How much do they compromise before they're not the Federation anymore? How far can you go? What will you do for survival before it's not worth surviving anymore, right? Before all the principles that you're living for and you're wearing this uniform for are violated and mean nothing. And at its best, Voyager has these very interesting, it pushes these characters to limits that you never see in another Star Trek show, because in another Star Trek show, there's always the Federation around to like bail the ship out if they get into trouble or reprimand them if they do the wrong thing. And that's not an option in Voyager. Voyager can break the Prime Directive and there's no one around to reprimand them, right? They're the only ship. They're the only people who are sort of accountable for their actions. And what I love about this episode is it's one of the only episodes in Voyager that like almost like characters, like, you know, they're like talking about this issue in a very literal way. And I just think it's very relevant to our current political climate. And I can't stop.
A little too relevant.
Yeah. I mean, I can't stop thinking about it because, and the, you know, just I don't want to beat around the bush, just to be blunt about it. Like, there's this conversation on the left that I think I don't have an easy answer for this. It's just a conversation, a question that's happening, which is how much does the left work with the Trump administration? Because Trump is this awful character. He represents a violation of almost every principle that I hold. I oppose almost everything that he believes. And even if I agree with him, I don't want to support him because his methodology is so against everything that I support.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, but at what point, but it's like, okay, but also like we live in the same country and we have to make peace. Like we have to have some common ground.
Well, in a nut, this ship is going through space. They find themselves in this place that is very strange. There are no stars. Long story short, they're trapped in this thing called the Void. And the Void is this very, very, very large area that's basically like a lobster trap. It captures ships in there. And once you are in the Void, it is very, very difficult, or it apparently impossible, to get out. The twist is that it basically becomes like those, now the lobsters that are in the trap are all fighting each other for their life. And the ones who get the toughest treatment are the new people who don't know what's going on in the Void. So people who are there are stuck there. Well, we meet one group that's been there for at least, I guess, 5 years. And so it's very much all against all. There's no sense of, what does CGP Grey call it? You know, a bigger army diplomacy. It's just, is that fair to say? It's all against all. This is hopeless. You're probably going to be here forever. You have to steal everything you can. Your energy is the nature of the Void, which I thought this was an interesting conceit. The nature of the energy in this place is that even just having the ship just doing nothing, it's using something like 10 times more deuterium or whatever of the energy source. Mm-hmm. And so basically our heroes land in this thing, don't know what the hell is going on. They're immediately set upon by other ships who see them as easy targets. Most of their energy and their food is transported off the ship by other ships. And now they don't know what's going on, and they realize they have a very limited amount of time to not only just figure this out, but even to just stay alive. It's a matter of days to figure out how they're going to stay alive because they've been plundered. And then the episode itself spins out. I mean, I don't want to spoil this, but the episode spins out with, well, okay, Captain Janeway and her strong feelings about following the rules of the Federation and their ethos has a somewhat unconventional approach to trying to not simply survive, but to stay hewn to the moral and ethical vision of the Federation in a place where even her own shipmates think that's not really that's not a sensible way to proceed. That really we have to use everything we can to just fight the way the others are fighting.
Yeah, that is a very good summary. And to me, the sort of pivotal plot point comes in when Janeway is sort of trying to make this alliance with these other ships, and her staff comes to her and says, you know, what the hell are you doing? You're like giving our supplies away and you're allying with these people who are going to stab us in the back. Wouldn't it be?
Well, and that's, I mean, we should say that if we're going to say, then we should say.
Yeah.
That's the twist. The twist is that Janeway says, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to do the opposite of that, which is we're not going to hoard our stuff and kill everybody. We're going to actually give our stuff away. We're going to collaborate. We're going to be open and vulnerable in order to build an alliance that will help us all benefit from each other's resources and technology in order to find some way to get out of this, which sounds bonkers to everybody.
Which that felt a little bit strange to me, because she has a very rational argument and she is like very brave. And, you know, we didn't mention this before, but the aliens that sort of come on the ship, they're almost like other people call them parasites, because they just jump from ship to ship.
Oh, right.
And there's this one guy who's like, oh God, how can you be on this ship? And she just shuts them down and is like, you will get out of this alliance if you fuck with people.
And other ships in there, people consider them a bit like rats,
yeah.
Jawas,
yeah,
vermin.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Like they're a nuisance and they're a threat and they carry disease and they're kind of like the Jawa Jews of the story.
Yeah.
And that felt that felt because it felt like this is Janeway like talking to some not an alt-right person, but just trying to be like, okay, we are going to try, but do not fuck with what we right. like and, our core beliefs.
And later, this guy, it's revealed that he basically like
he blew up
a ship and stole some technology that they needed so that they could do their escape plan. And Janeway kicks him off out of the alliance and gets rid of the tech, like throws out the tech that he stole, even though they need it. And what I think I think that's interesting because the story shows Janeway as this sort of like moral authority, and it shows that she's willing to bend. So she's willing to compromise her morals, and she's willing to compromise the Starfleet code to ally with these unsavory characters. She's willing to put aside the security of the ship and all of their procedures in the Starfleet way and bend in order to survive and prosper. But she's not willing to break. There's like a line between being flexible and selling out everything you believe to survive. And I feel like so often when we get, you know, like I was saying, this debate on the left of like let's say you work for, you know, a tech company, right? And the White House calls up and says, the president is asking you to serve your country. Will you come be part of do some digital thing for the Trump White House? And on the one hand, even if you hate Trump and you hate everything he stands for and you oppose his methodology, you want the country to prosper and you want Trump to have the best people to make the country work. Like our success depends, people will even be mad at me for saying this, but our success is tied up with
Trump. I know, because you're normalizing it.
But I'm sorry, but he's the president and our success is tied up with his. And you want him to have a competent staff who can do a good job to do the right thing for the country. And you want people in the administration to tell him no and to tell him that there are moral lines. And you'll never get those people if everyone on our side stands on principle and refuses to compromise. Like if no one is willing to bend, then we've lost, then we'll never get anything.
The thing that was running through my mind this whole episode, there were two things really running through my mind. The giant thing was, and this is not going to be a popular thing to say, but this is what was on my mind. Well, you know, let me get the little one. Here's the little one. Is I watched this not very long after a surfeit of news that indicates that, according to our intelligence community, I'm not a scholar of this, but it is my understanding that there is a lot of agreement inside the American intelligence community that basically the Russians, some actors acting on behalf of Russia, had an influence, wanted to have an influence on the election. Further to that point, we learned that there's a pretty good chance that that the Russian government or oligarchy was involved. Further to that, at the time I was watching this, it was becoming very clear, at least according to the failing New York Times, that there's a very high certainty that probably Putin and his people specifically approved a program to tamper with the election in a way that would help Donald Trump win. Okay, so that's the little thing. And so Barack Obama comes out and says, nothing to me sounds weaker than a president saying, oh, we will react at a time of our choosing, but whatever, that's fine. But, you know, here's the thing. So we got hacked by the Russians. And so what do you do in retaliation? Do you hack them back? Well, you know what? I'm going to say, I mean, it's probably happening anyway, but my feeling would be no, because that's not who we are. The thing is, whatever it is that we do in retaliation, like, first of all, is that gonna unring that bell? No, but it's how you react to things that says how you will be judged in life. It's not what happens to you, it's how you react to it. And in that case, like, that's not the America that we want. We don't want to say that what they did is okay by doing it back to them. If somebody attacks you with chemical weapons, do you attack them back with chemical weapons because it's wrong to use chemical weapons? That's the little thing I got out of this. And then there's the other one. I'm going to shut up in a minute. But the thing is, all of our buddies out there who are very upset about Donald Trump, I'm one of those people. But think about everything that a lot of our buddies are coming up with ways to say, well, you know, you want to find the faithless electors. You want to do this. You want to pull this little trick. For every little thing you're doing because Trump, ask yourself how you would feel if people did that if Clinton won.
Oh, my God. That's so true. These people
every single thing. So we've decided that this is extraordinary enough that now the rules are off. And I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I just want people to really fucking think about it. It's every little rogue maneuver that you want to pull to fuck with Donald Trump, whether or not it's going to work. And it probably won't work because he's got the entire Congress and government behind him. But even if it were effective, do you want that to be the precedent? We set a precedent with Obama about what's okay to do with drones. Like what you're allowed to do with the NSA, knowing those powers are in place with good old grandpa, Uncle Barry. Like, are you happy to know that Trump will now have access to those same things? For every one of these things that you think is going to fix this problem, ask yourself if you want that to be the precedent going forward, because that's what Captain Janeway is dealing with. And I found it incredibly affecting.
That's exactly what was going through my mind when I was watching this. And you know, people on Twitter, like I've seen so many people say, like, you know, in despair, as Trump is sort of, you know, the recount didn't happen and the electors didn't abandon Trump and all these sort of plots that never were going to happen don't happen. People keep saying, why isn't Obama do something? Like, he should do something. What do they imagine him doing? Like, what do you want?
Every time you have one of these, I'm repeating myself, but every time you've got some kind of big hack for how you're going to fix the Donald Trump problem, ask yourself how much you want that to be the precedent for what an actual grown-up president is allowed to do in the future. Don't let this guy throw you so far off your fucking nut that you start thinking that the ultimate normalization is acting like we should tear down the supporting beams of our entire system of government and our entire ethos as a nation in order to figure out how to fix this one fucktard.
One of the thing is and this is not a popular thing to say, but when I see all my friends and people who I like agree with, who are also like, we try to consider ourselves pacifists and try to really care, and they're just not about this peaceful transition of power. I'm like, what? Where else do you want to live?
He won. He won the election, guys. He won.
To say he won it fairly, I'm not smart enough to think about that. But like to say, not my president. No, he literally will be your president. That is factually wrong. And people, I get it. I really do. And I understand the despair and the fear, especially with people who are I've talked to a lot of like kids who were powerless to vote, and I can definitely, I don't know. People are gonna be so mad at me. But I just can't, like, what do you think is going to happen? What are these angry tweets going to accomplish? Let me
flush this out a second, because I think like the gay rights issue is a good issue to talk about, because it's a real issue where so much is at stake for real people. So, you know, let's just take for granted that we have a true moral commitment to legal protection for gay people in this country, and that morally we're driven to pursue this issue. Now, if you have a true moral commitment to this issue, I'm honestly asking you guys, because this is something like I'm struggling with on so many issues. Do you die on the hill of the moral purity of your positions? And do you say, well, I care about this issue so much that I will not move an inch, and you'll have to, I'm going to lay down on the tracks, and you're going to have to drive this train over me to, you know, I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm throwing my gears on the body, my body on the gears here. Like right. This, yeah. Like, you will do nothing. I will not move an inch, right? Because I have moral clarity, and I'm clear, and I know exactly where I stand on this issue, and I won't move at all. Or that's one version. Or do you say, I care so much about the issue of gay rights that I'm actually willing to engage with this guy and compromise and give some things up so that we have like rule of law, I live to fight another day, and we get some of what we want. You know, that's the sort of Obama thing. Like, do you want to say like, well, 1% is better than 0%, so I'll take 1% today and live to fight again? And I'm honestly asking, like, because gay rights is such a great issue to think about for this, because you're it's not abstract, right? Like only, you know, getting a compromise on gay rights is, it sucks for people. It has real legal and actual material ramifications for people's lives. Are they going to be admitted to the hospital room? Are they going to be able to get the tax benefits of marriage? Are they going to have dignity under the law? Like, those are real things. So where, I'm just curious, like, do you guys have a thought on this?
I mean, we sort of had that already with, like, okay, domestic partnerships, we'll take it. And it was still hard. You still couldn't, you know, lots of people wouldn't provide insurance. And it's hard to say. Like, you can't really literally die on the tracks of, gay marriage, but you can.
You could chain yourself to the door of Capitol Hill. I'm serious. You could go to your congressman's office and handcuff yourself to the door and say, "I take the only way I'm moving is if you arrest me. And here's my issue. Let's do this." Like, if all that mattered was the moral clarity of your position on this issue, you would sacrifice yourself symbolically or literally to accomplish your ends.
If I okay, so I know we're both fans of Rules for Radicals, and if I had a concrete, like if there was some sort of concrete effect of that, then yes. Like there's been a lot of stuff about like what protests work and what don't, and why they don't. And I've been in that position before, and I've done things that have concretely helped. And other times it was, you know, just being an angry kid and it didn't help. So like, yes, for that, like if my alderman is like, hey, you your wife can't see you in the hospital, it, like that, this is a very like real thing for me. Like, yeah, that is something. For sure. And like, if there is a registry of any people in the U.S. that are going to be discriminated against, like, yeah, my name is on that list. And I think that I don't want to be like on that high horse or anything, but like, because I'm like sort of, you know, a recovering bendy Catholic. So I don't have a strict moral imperative, because like that you have to bend and you can't break. So I'm chaining myself.
So the Saul Alinsky book Rules for Radicals, Hail Satan, The Solid Landscape Book Rule for Radicals. I mean, this is, you know, for me, coming out of sort of Chicago political organizing, like on the streets, right? Like, this is my Bible of political engagement. And I'll read just a little couple paragraphs here because he is, there's no ambiguity in the book here about, and Solid Landscape, for people who don't know, he's sort of considered like the father of like street organizing and leftist sort of political organizing. He's considered the greatest political organizer and one of the most important like political thinkers in American politics, and like the left would do well to read him, and people who do read him are very successful in Democratic politics, and even the right is sort of begrudgingly beginning to accept his way of thinking about politics and his tactics. But this is from his book. This is a little section from his book in Rules for Radicals about the topic of means and ends. And you guys know what I mean by means and ends. The ends is what you're trying to accomplish. The means is like how you do it, right?
For most people, as long as they can conceive of the importance of the end, there's almost endless flexibility on what you do for the means. The more you believe in the importance of the end, the more likely you are to think that the means can be very fungible.
Right. I think. And that is sort of the core, I think, of the ethical topic in this episode of Voyager and this whole conversation. So anyway, here's what Solinsky says. He says, this is with regards to this question of like ends and means and like, do you compromise or do you like die on the tracks? So he says, that perennial question, does the end justify the means, is meaningless as it stands. The real and only question regarding the ethics of means and ends is, and always has been, does this particular end justify this particular means? Life and how you live it is the story of a means and ends. The end is what you want, and the means is how you get it. Whenever we think about social change, the question of means and ends arises. The man of action views the issue of means and ends in pragmatic and strategic terms. He has no other problem. He thinks only of his actual resources and the possibilities of various choices of action. He asks of ends only whether they are achievable and worth the cost. Of means, only whether they will work. To say that corrupt means corrupt the ends is to believe in the immaculate conception of ends and principles. The real arena is corrupt and bloody. Life is a corrupting process from the time a child learns to play his mother off of his father in the politics of when to go to bed. He who fears corruption fears life. The practical revolutionary will understand Goethe's conscience is the virtue of observers and not of agents of action. In action, one does not always enjoy the luxury of decision that is consistent both with one's individual conscience and the good of mankind. The choice must always be for the latter. Action is for mass salvation and not for the individual's personal salvation. He who sacrifices the mass good for his personal conscience has a peculiar conception of personal salvation. He doesn't care enough for people to be corrupted for them.
That's the part where I cried on an airplane when I read that.
I mean, it's
a thing. It's a thing that happens.
But to me, what's interesting about this is you have, you know, to go back to Voyager for a second, you have Janeway making all of these compromises on the security of Voyager. She's giving parts and tools and pieces to the people who she's trying to court to be in the Alliance. And her crew keeps coming to her and saying, what the hell are you doing? Like, you're risking our security. You're compromising with these people who are trying to destroy us. You're giving away more and more. And Janeway keeps saying, I'll just read this little, hang on, I pulled it up here. She says, Seven of Nine at one point comes to Janeway and says, it's when Tuvok and Chakotay, the security officer and the second officer, or the first officer, are in Janeway's office, right? And they come to her and they say, I can't believe you're giving away things to these our enemies, right? And Janeway says, I've become convinced that we've got to stick to our principles, not abandon them. And Chakotay says, should the crew be ready to die for those principles? And Janeway says, if the alternative means becoming thieves and killers ourselves, yes. But I'm betting that our principles are going to keep us alive. And that just really struck me as, like, this is a very clever dramatization of this, like, Saul Alinsky thing of, like a good leader and a good strategic leader who will win a battle is willing to think conditionally and to know that there's a difference between bending your principles and breaking them, and that it's not binary, that there is no black and white, that you do what you can with what you have as much as you can, and what you have to sort of contextually be comfortable with that ambiguity of trying to know where that gray area is and walk right up to the line, and then when you hit that line to stop and say, we're not going to move any further.
Yeah, I know you're not a Walking Dead fan, but that's one of the themes that's become so interesting in the Walking Dead as the story develops, especially through the first into the second season, is that, you know, there's this sense of, in the face of this really disastrous situation, how does this group try to hew to the morality of the time before the disaster?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, as you can, spoiler alert, as you can kind of imagine, it becomes untenable. You have to do things in The Walking Dead. You have to do things that you would never even have a nightmare about. Like, you're going, if your kid gets bitten by a walker, like, you're not just going to, like, pacify them. You have to, like, kill them through the brain. Because after they die, they'll still come back as a walker. It's that's what makes that show so claustrophobic in some ways, is that, you know, you see these little bits of humanity as people, you know, they go through the kind of the Maslow hierarchy until it's just all the way down to, like, how do I just stop from going all the way into all against all, not stealing from my group? And then that gets played out in different ways. This is not just The Walking Dead, but I think that's one theme that's interesting in apocalyptic things, is, like, you know, when we've given up all of our moral moorings, or that's been forced upon us, like, how do we react to that? And at what point do we decide to give up this thing that used to seem precious to us in order to survive? And then what do you gamble or trade in order to keep some other piece alive? And as that gets more desperate and more chairs get removed from that game of musical chairs, it becomes more and more tense. And I don't know. I think it's always interesting to put yourself, whether that's going to be, you know, Rick, or that's going to be, you know, Captain Janeway. It's interesting to put yourself in. You can't help but think, what would I do in that situation? You know, if her goal is to, above all, make sure that her ship is intact and everybody lives, she might do something differently. So the question becomes, does she think that the Alliance is actually the best tactical thing, as well as the best moral and ethical thing?
I know this, right? Is often talked about in jest, but do you ever talk to your wife, like, what, okay, so if there is a natural disaster, and let's say zombies, however it happens, are a thing, have you ever had a conversation like, okay, what do we do? Do we stay alive? Do we do it for our kid? Do we just, you know, run for the hills? Do we
specifically
put a bullet
with zombies?
No, I'm saying
it's a good conversation to have. I know John and Amy Gruber have a plan worked out in case they do a face-off style face swap. If one of them gets face swapped, I think they've worked out, like, a safe word so they can know which one's the real them. These are things to work out. I think if you're going to be in a relationship, you should talk about zombies and face swaps.
I mean, I just think about, well, it's also sort of the thing of, I don't know. It's like, how long do you wait to see if there's a cure before you pull the if you shoot your loved one in the head? Like, how long do you wait until you take them off life support? I don't know.
I know exactly what you're saying. Did you ever see the Silent Life sketch the day Beyonce turned black?
Yes.
It's very, very funny. And it's probably my daughter's favorite Saturday Night Live sketch I've ever shown her. And it's basically about, like, right after the Super Bowl, Beyonce has put out Formation. And it's shot as basically the trailer for a horror movie. And it's the day that white people realize that, first, that Beyonce is black, and that, second, maybe this song is not for them. And the entire city is melting down. People are screaming and running in the streets. They don't even recognize their friends anymore because they're realizing they might be black.
It's so good. Also, your daughter is probably the coolest person that I just aspire to be her. God, she's great.
We haven't talked that much about the actual episode and implementation.
Well, how much can you? I mean, it's a. I mean, Voyager is trashy. I mean, I love it. It's one of my favorite shows, and I'll be the first to admit it's like.
Well, I want to hand it some plaudits. I mean,
it's pretty, like, campy and bad.
But this as an episode is so, it's such a good standalone episode. Like, you recommended another episode if we wanted to watch more.
Mm-hmm.
And I started that and I was just like, I don't care.
You know what?
Confused.
That was bad. I was sort of trying to improvise on the spot, and I was thinking to myself, where does this show get good? Like, where, mm-hmm. if you're watching it, where's the moment where you're like,
What's their Greg Pakaitis episode?
Thank you. That, yeah. Thank you. And that's the Greg Pakaitis episode. If you're watching it for the first two seasons, that the season two finale kicks off this great storyline that is the where the show kind of gets good, and you're like,
oh, the master plan episode.
Yes. And yeah. And you know what? I went back and watched it last night actually because I was like, oh, I wonder...
Master Plan is so good. It's such a good episode.
Wait, what is Master Plan?
Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking about the season finale of season two of Parks and Rec.
Oh, no, no. No, sorry. I'm talking about, so I had recommended if you guys, because, so Merlin right. texted.
Oh, my God. That's a really terrible coincidence. What you had, so my daughter and I were basically up to the end. She was loving it. And she said, let's go watch the first episode.
Right.
And so mm-hmm. I texted you and said, we're excited. Should we watch the first episode? And you said.
Well, the pilot episode of Voyager is notoriously, it's so boring and bad. It's just awful. And, I was like, do not watch the pilot, and I sort of hastily improvised this episode to go to, which is the season two finale called Basics Part One, and that's to me, that's a moment where Voyager kind of like hits a good note for the first time. It's like, all right, like I see what this show can kind of do. But, you know, I went back and watched it last night to be like, hey, I wonder if this sort of like holds up as like a good, you know, a good episode to go to. And it does not. It you need to have seen so much nonsense before that. It's just sort of, I don't know.
Well, I want to hand out some plaudits. First of all, I have no problem. I just sent you the Beyoncé Turn Black video, Alex. You should show that to Max. I'm always grading on a curve. At least mentally, I'm thinking like take into account when this was made. Take into account like where this aired. Like, was this on like what was this on like CW or something probably or Fox? What was this on?
CBS and then syndicated on UPN.
Yeah,
UPN. Okay. Okay, but like I have no problem taking all that into account. So I was ready to look past any kind of like, you know, because like I say, I'd seen one episode of the show before that was not very good. It was really cheap and cheesy. But I one thing I thought they did very well, and I don't even know when this is from, they did a good job, I thought, of dealing with a large cast, for one thing. Like, there was something for a lot of people to do in this, and I feel like I learned a little bit about lots of characters that wasn't... You know, a lot of times when you get this kind of an episode, you'll have, like, you know, you'll have the antagonist, the person who disagrees with them, and then the protagonist, the person who disagrees with them, and the antagonist, and that's the show. I thought it was interesting. I thought it was a team effort, and, you know, I don't know. I don't expect other episodes of the show to be this good, but I think you've picked a really great one.
I was just thinking about the first scene of this episode, and it's super
where they're having
short.
The fancy dinner.
Yeah.
And
it's not nearly as bad as you made it sound.
It's so cringeworthy.
I loved it. Okay, here's the...
I thought it was adorable.
Exactly, and it made me immediately invested in these characters, because it's goofy, and it's like, what the heck is going on here?
But it also sets the tone for, like, I mean, what you don't realize until you're halfway into it is, oh, I wish we could go back to the days where the guy who looks like a toucan could make anything out of food.
Yeah.
Like, it's this moment of plenty.
Right.
Like, right before all the privation that I think really works.
I mean, that's how my favorite Doctor Who episodes are set up, when typically it's not necessarily there's not stakes for the Doctor and his companion, but you need to establish stakes for the other people in this episode. And the ones that do that best usually have like this quirky little scene where you just, there's something about it that just hits you. And the first scene really did that for me. It was dumb, but it was still cute.
I don't know. Maybe
Max made it sound like it was going to be like do-to-do baggy pants comedy. And I thought
yeah,
it was better than that.
Maybe I am grading on a curve because I was like, here it comes.
I think you guys generally have, I think most people generally have a higher tolerance for campiness than I do. And especially for sort of intentional campiness. So like I don't mind the campiness of something old where you can go back and watch it and be like, in its day, this was very earnest, but now we can find a sort of campy humor in it, and the aesthetic of camp as like we're gonna intentionally go in and make something kind of zany and campy, I find it really cringeworthy and awful and trying too hard. And it's like you know the thing of like don't let them see a sweat. When something is campy, like I can see every bead of sweat on the writer's forehead as they're pounding away on the keys. They're just like, they're trying so fucking hard to make this like adorably.
Well, it feels like something you're doing for children and old people.
Yeah,
like you're trying to do something that a child could laugh at because it's funny and silly, or something that somebody can feel warm about because they're some kind of notional old person who's sentimental. And I think for somebody somebody who's used to like getting straight to like the in media res plot of something, it really feels like unnecessary throat clearing that panders to somebody who's not you.
Maybe that's it. And it's just a try hard thing that like upsets me. And it's a reason like I absolutely cannot get into Doctor Who, because Doctor Who is so campy. They're like, it's the wobbly time stuff or whatever. And he like puts on his hat and they make witticisms and he dances across the screen. Like, get that out of there. Like, I can't stand that
stuff. These things used to upset me, Max, when you would say these things that weren't accurate. But then I realized that despite the things where you have great taste, you have terrible taste about something, and you're a snob. And I think you like being a snob, and that makes you even worse as a snob. And to be a snob with such unreliable taste might make you a terrible person.
Merlin, if this was on Twitter, I would send you a GIF to change your mind of the what's his name? The captain from the doctor from Doctor Who, and he'd be like tying his scarf, and he'd like wink into the camera and be like, "We're all made of stars." And then everyone would a single tear would roll down their face, and they'd be like, "It's so true."
Oh my god, I love that episode.
So
it's the star stuff.
Max is about 5 years older than me, and I was at a conference in November, and everybody kept saying, "Oh man, you remind me so much of Max Temkin." And I
wait, what? Like, what?
At
what?
Ool. What? Yeah, yeah.
Alex, it is true that we're like almost the same.
We
listen to the same music. We listen to the same podcast. We have the same T-shirts. We have the same haircut. We like.
I go to Supercuts, and
I go to the Supercuts that's closer to me. I go to the Floyd's that's closer to me. We have the same laptop, and for a while we had the same stickers on our same like Mac products. Like, Alex, it's frightening. We both like women.
Well, that's a good point.
Merlin, when I first started working at Cards, I noticed this right away, like, oh fuck, I dress nearly identically as my boss. And I've slowly started to just kind of basically wear pajamas to work unless like we have an event or something. And
put on a nice frock for the day.
And we both had used this service called Trunk Club and
Trunk Club.
Yeah, and I was like, fuck.
Alex, you want to tell me about something you like?
Oh god. I used to like it until we all we had the same thing. So now whenever we have to be on like film, I bring an extra shirt in case Max is wearing the same one.
So Alex and I both did Trunk Club, and for the same reason, which was we both went to an event where we got a gift card for Trunk Club. And then we both canceled Trunk Club for the same reason, which is they refused to send us boring enough clothes. I kept asking for like, I was like, is there like some sort of black sweater you could send me? Or like,
I want to get something. I want to join a club where they send me the same Uniqlo or black long sleeve shirt.
Is that so much to ask? And then what happened was my personal stylist at Trunk Club sent me a box, and she was like, "Here's a box of like fun green sweaters and shoes for St. Patrick's Day."
The cravat.
Yeah, so you could go. So when you go out partying on St. Patrick's Day, you'll have like fun green, you know, button down shirts to wear. And like, I was like, I must cancel the service.
Mm-mm. Sorry to lose you as a sponsor.
They're a very nice company. I just
Clear, they are not a sponsor of this episode. This episode is, however, sponsored by the Helix Sleep System and MeUndies.
Okay, here's the thing.
They're sewn with special silver thread.
To MeUndies, you can get the same black underwear every month. It's pretty great.
There's someone in this office. Can I just tell you, there's not a podcast ad that exists where someone doesn't fucking get it in this office. I see all the shit. Yep. I see Casper shit coming in. I see people do that. What's the thing where if you're too lazy to buy groceries, they send you like a corn.
Oh, Blue Apron.
People getting Blue Apron. I see people
Blue
getting...
Blue Apron is a service that sends you several... basically, delivers small plastic bags to your house that probably contain food.
try this Thai chili recipe. Here's a little bit of time.
Someone posted a picture on Twitter of opening their Blue Apron, and they opened this precious little cardboard container, and there was a single egg in there. And it,
oh, yeah.
And
it's adorable.
And it said label. It had a label on it, and it said farm egg. And they just said, here is the farm egg.
I have mixed feelings. Like they've sponsored shows I've been on, and we have subscribed. My problem is like we have a fairly small refrigerator, and like one delivery, like a delivery from them that creates like three meals fills our entire refrigerator with matter. And it just is like, ugh. I had a funny occasion, I think it was about a week ago, I was talking about this on Slack, where I was wearing four articles of clothing that had been given to me by three different sponsors. And I never felt like such a shill in my entire life. My socks, two of my shirts, and my jacket, like, had come from, yeah.
Well, here's the thing I will say about foot cardigan.
Foot cardigan!
They're like hugs for your feet or whatever. I don't know. But I, of course, because I'm a millennial, I'm like, huh, I wonder. And there's all these, you know, decorative socks, and I'm like, oh, fuck this. But then they have a collection called Borings. And
they got their no-show option.
Yeah, and they'll just send you black socks every month. And I'm like, I don't...
Perfect. I wish Gold Toe Socks. I wish I would get a sponsorship from Gold Toe Socks, and I could be like Jerry Lewis, never wear the same pair of socks twice. I would love it if I was just delivered white Gold Toe socks every month, and I could just throw them away.
Listen. I know the Gold Toe people are listening to this. Listen, here's the deal. Here's what we want. We want 365 pairs of Gold Toe Socks per year. In exchange, we will read an ad. Now that's a product I believe in. I'm a Gold Toe man. Are you a Gold Toe man, Merlin?
I am. Gold Toe Socks. These are totally socks.
I'm a Gold Toe man.
Thank you for supporting.
I go to Target and I buy a potato sack of Gold Toe Socks.
I get them from Amazon in 8-packs.
Yeah. I buy the largest amount I can, and then I retire. Like, I'll wear them for 2 or 3 years, retire the whole potato sack, buy a new potato sack of Gold Toe Socks. And, boy, I really believe in this product, and if they would sponsor us just by giving us the socks, we will continue to talk about how good Gold Toe Socks are. If you do not meet our demands in the next 20, we will execute one hostage every hour on the hour until we receive our free socks.
And but here's the great thing too about Gold Toe Socks. I used to be a Hanes girl, but the problem with that is every year they change like the design of what their branding is called. It's like Cool Heat or Heat Off Cool, and they change the bottom of the sock, so then when you're matching your socks, they don't. You have to like put effort into it.
Oh, come on!
And I'm like, no,
that's planned obsolescence. That's the worst.
Yes, it is.
Alex, do you find with the Hanes? So I used to get Hanes because I think they're the cheapest sock by
volume.
Mm-hmm. And so I used to get Hanes. I like having a lot of socks. Here's the thing: I don't like running out of socks, so I have a lot of socks.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So I'll go, but for volume. Now, here's the thing with Hanes: you wash those things 5 or 6 times, and they get lumpy. It feels like you have marbles in your shoes. Do you?
Oh,
not...
no, that's no good. You won't get that with the Gold Toe family of Gold Toe Men's Cotton Standard Crew Athletic Socks, white 6-pack sock size 10 to 13. You don't get that with those,
Merlin. This is wow.
Troubling, very troubling.
Yeah, I'm looking at an Amazon search history here, and it just scrolls down as far as the eye can see, and there's just
November. It looks like around autumn. Well, look at that. Around autumn every year, I get around my birthday, I just really get excited about socks.
Now you do a white. This is very interesting. You do a white sock.
I do a white sock. Yeah, these are just the Gold Toes. These are not all of my socks, but no, I'll just go like, oh, I'm done with these. Like, I want the dirty ones to go away, and I want fresh ones. Now, Jerry Lewis, you book a gig for Jerry Lewis. He wants a fresh pair of socks. In the dressing room, he's never worn the same pair of socks twice.
Why white socks? Why?
Yeah,
why
do you wear white socks? Because
I'm a pretty athletic guy. I like to push my extremity to the edge. I'm kind of the Casey Neistat of not doing videos.
Okay.
The makeup on this show was way better than I expected. It was not Doctor Who level of cheap, that's for sure.
The makeup on Voyager won many awards, and they invented many makeup technologies that were proprietary to the show that have changed.
But like the guy
business.
That had the mean guy, the Donald Trump guy who had an axe for a face, that was a nice effect.
They had very cool. Voyager has probably the best makeup of any like sci-fi show. Like it's notably like extremely cool every episode.
I have a quick question for Max.
Yes, you there.
Did anybody on Voyager work on Battlestar?
Okay, so there is. So I don't want to get too deep into the whole politics of the Star Trek writers' room because I could go. It's a thing I weirdly know way too much about. Yeah, but so Ronald D. Moore is the guy who made Battlestar Galactica, right? And he comes from Next Generation. He got hired on a spec script for Next Generation, and he became the guy. He wrote a spec script and mailed it in, and they hired him. And he became the Klingon expert, and he was sort of the go-to guy to write the gritty, realistic like Klingon episodes. Ronald D. Moore in season 3 of Deep Space Nine, Next Generation ends, and the Next Generation writing staff splits up between the two shows. There's Deep Space Nine, which is 3 years in, and there's Voyager, which is just starting. It's brand new. It's the golden child network television replacement for Star Trek, The Next Generation. All of the quote-unquote good writers, the sort of like more, I would say, they describe them as the more sentimental Star Trek-y writers, go to Voyager. And they continue, you know, they make Voyager into this planet of the week, sort of a lightly campy, a rollicking adventure. All of the sort of gritty, weirdo, we want to push the boundaries of television writers go to Deep Space Nine. And they turn Deep Space Nine into this serialized, like, long arc. Like, you can't just watch an episode of Deep Space Nine. You have to watch the whole thing, right? And they really push Deep Space Nine in crazy directions, and they became, like, the bastard stepchild of Star Trek. After Deep Space Nine ends, that group of people, a lot of them left the Star Trek universe. Ronald D. Moore, pretty instrumental guy in Star Trek at that point. He tried to go to Voyager, and he wound up fighting with Michael Piller and the other producers of Voyager so much that they fired him, basically. Like, he quit. I don't know. But he had some sort of awful person. He wrote one episode that was just okay, had a terrible personality conflict, and left. And he reacted so strongly to that and what he felt was broken about Star Trek that he went off and made Battlestar Galactica. And, you know, it's sort of interesting because, like, Ronald D. Moore has said, you know, to him, the whole premise of Voyager is this ship is out there in the Delta Quadrant. They're a million miles from home. They have no help anywhere. What he wanted to see was every week them scrabbling and struggling for survival and selling out their principles piece by piece, and that he wanted it to be a Ship of Theseus situation where every week something breaks on the ship and they have to replace it with something worse, and eventually at the end they come limping back home and they're changed. They're not even recognizable. Wow. And that's a fact. I mean, that I want to see that show. That's an awesome, modern, cool Star Trek show. Voyager is emphatically not that, right? A sort of hilarious trope of Voyager is they have these shuttlecraft. You guys know the shuttlecraft in Star Trek? They're these little mini spaceships they can launch to go on like an away mission. Voyager destroys like an average of one shuttlecraft per episode, and they never seem to run out of shuttlecraft. And that's like the perfect, you know, it's like the perfect metaphor for like the magic of this show of like nothing ever breaks. They never run out of food or water.
Oh, it kind of resets a little bit each week.
Very much so. And even though they have nowhere to build a new shuttlecraft or get those materials or whatever. So you just accept that that's part of the magic of Voyager, I guess. But one thing I like about The Void is that it is the rare episode of Voyager that kind of goes down that, like, what-if path of, like, oh, this is interesting. Like, it's like, one thing that's kind of cool about the episode is it's, like, dark for half of the episode because the ship is running on low power. And that's just interesting. It's like, you don't see that in Star Trek a lot. Like, you know, they don't fix everything right away. That's kind of a cool, I just kind of thought that was a cool conceit of this episode. So anyway, that is the crossover with Battlestar Galactica. Battlestar Galactica is very directly a reaction to some of the Star Trek writers like Ronald D. Moore saying, boy, Star Trek has lost its way and it doesn't have anything relevant to say. And we're going to go make this show that's like dark and gritty and can talk about 9/11, you know, and has something to say about human nature. And that's a real divergence between in the Star Trek world of like the Voyager people on one hand and the like more Battlestar Galactica people on the other.
I can tell that I'm going to go on a tangent reading tonight because Battlestar is probably my favorite modern sci-fi show.
Well, Alex, watch Deep. Don't watch Voyager. Watch Deep Space Nine.
That's what I'm thinking. Like this sounds fantastic. And
yeah, it was so weird. No one cared about Deep Space Nine. Like the network left it alone. Like no one meddled with it. Like they always talked about how like they basically felt like the producers felt like that the inmates were running the asylum and the writers had just like taken this show like off into the wilderness. And so they just no one knew what to do. So they just ignored it. And it got so weird and good. It holds up. That Deep Space Nine is the only one that holds up today and is not that campy.
Huh.
Anyway.
I feel silly to even ask this because you've almost certainly seen it. Have you ever seen the Portlandia episode called One More Episode?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Do me a favor and watch that episode. It's called One More Episode. You might enjoy it.
Oh, that's about the Battlestar Galactica. Where they yeah. can't stop. Yeah, yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that.
And Ronald D. Moore is on there, but not as himself.
Right, that's right.
Yeah. And the electric gets shut off because they keep watching. We went through that with Battlestar Galactica. That was like the wire for us. We were like, oh, we can't watch three in one night, can we? It's like, the Cylons have a plan. Oh, my God.
That was
I loved it so much.
I feel like, you know, those millennials, like we really pioneered binge watching because we had Christmas breaks where we had nothing to do, like watching
the scene when they're sitting around the black guy's house and he has no idea what they're talking. That actor, they use him a lot on Portlandia, and he's so
amazing.
Fucking funny. And they're in the tiny little place, like in the closet, typing, and the wife throws them. It's so good. I didn't realize the first time I watched that. I didn't realize that that was him. That was Ronald. That's his name, right? Ronald D. Moore.
Yes.
I didn't realize that was him, and then I watched it again. I was like, "This is the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life."
Yeah, listening to him like talk about Star Trek and how Star Trek lost its way during this era of like the Voyager.
You talked about this in one of your guides.
Yes.
This, I think, in your Next Generation guide.
Yeah, he's very bold. He's like Star Trek has become like boring, and it's these like goofy, but weirdly self-serious men, and they're all wearing matching pajamas, and they're sitting staring at the television, and like they're like, how do you like tell a story about humanity that way? He really, you know, he was like the guy to make that criticism, and he did it very well.
Challenge. It's my week to pick a challenge, and I have a challenge for you to do over the next week. Are you ready to hear it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I had an idea for this. I'm going to roll it back and make it easy. This week, I would like you to take at least 2 naps on purpose. I'm not going to be too demanding about it, but I would like you, and don't get too worked up about it, but on at least 2 occasions this week, at a time of your choosing, I would like for you to purposely go to a couch or a bed and make the conditions appropriate to take a nap. Whatever you think is appropriate, whatever you call a nap is fine, but I would like you to try taking 2 naps this week.
Does it count if you're with like a racist uncle and you just drink yourself to sleep?